Chapter 8, A Personal Breakthrough. This chapter starts with a quote from Black Elk Speaks. I was in the air with outstretched arms and floating fast. There was a fearful dark river that I had to go over, and I was afraid. It rushed and roared and was full of angry foam. Then I looked down and saw many men and women who were trying to cross the dark and fearful river, but they could not. Weeping, they looked up to me and cried, "Help us!" But I could not stop gliding, for it was as though a great wind were under me. Again by Black Elk Speaks. When Ted Kennedy was running for president in 1980, Bobby had traveled to South Dakota to campaign for his uncle. There, Bill Walsh had long been active in the state's Democratic Party and remained a staunch Kennedy supporter. Though Walsh was 15 years older than Bobby, they took to each other right away. He arranged for Bobby to stay in Deadwood's historic Franklin Hotel that he co-managed, and where Bobby then established South Dakota's Ted Kennedy for President headquarters. Walsh also organized several local TV appearances for Bobby and accompanied him to the Pine Ridge and Rosebud Indian reservations that his father had visited during his presidential campaign. After they touched base again at the Democratic Convention, Bobby decided to return to Deadwood for the remainder of the summer. A good old boy activist in a cowboy hat, Walsh had been the chaplain for the state prison and co-chaired South Dakota's Prison Reform Committee before resigning from the priesthood and becoming coordinator of social services for the Black Hills. Bill was a big, strong, sort of ham-fisted, square-jawed Irishman, Bobby recalls, a very funny, unusual guy who went from being a priest to running a bar and hotel. He continued to kind of minister to people from behind the bar. At the time, Bobby had a drug problem. I was what I'd call an addict for 14 years, he later told an interviewer. I became an addict for the same reasons most people do, which is they have a big empty hole inside, and that was the one thing that could fill it. Walsh remembered in 2022, we talked and Bobby was very upfront about his drug addiction, but that he wanted to become a lawyer. It was very important for Bobby to get in physical shape so he could overcome his addiction. So we did a lot of running and we worked out together. Two summers later, in 1982, Walsh put him up in one of his cabins in the Black Hills so he would study for retaking the bar exam. Bobby remembered, I was there for 3 months. It was inaccessible by road. I bought a dirt bike that was the only way you could get up to it. I would take my bike into town to get groceries and then cook back there. I had to bring water from a well about 100 feet from the cabin, so it was kind of primitive and a good place for me to be quiet. He later wrote down, addiction baffled me. I was hard-headed and proud of my ability to bear pain and of my iron willpower in other areas of my life. But my willpower was bafflingly ineffective against the compulsion of my drug addiction. The promises to quit that I made sincerely and earnestly would soon stop binding me, and the intervals between promise and drugs got shorter over time, dropping from months to weeks to days and finally hours. I had to continuously lower my standards and my aspirations to keep pace with my declining conduct. Addiction is a disease of isolation, and although I was often surrounded by people, my world over time grew smaller and smaller. His friend Chris Bartle remembers, one thing Bobby said always stuck with me. It was, I would rather be in a pit of poison, snakes, than to take drugs again. There was nothing he wanted more in the world, but he just couldn't do it. Bobby recalls, to me, the most demoralizing feature of this disease was my incapacity to keep contracts with myself. Determined to give Bill Walsh's form of therapy one more try, he was aboard a plane to South Dakota on September 11, 1983, when he appeared to be suffering an almost fatal overdose. Arrested upon landing, he received help from Walsh to enter a rehabilitation facility in New Jersey. "I was completely broken," he says. "I knew I needed a profound spiritual realignment." Bobby reflected back on his upbringing. Raised in a pious Irish Catholic family, he and his siblings had read Lives of the Saints. These were men who'd had spiritual epiphanies. St. Francis of Assisi, St. Paul at Damascus, St. Thomas Aquinas, all of them had led dissolute lives as alcoholics or other forms of debauchery. St. Augustine particularly suffered sex and alcohol addiction, and then had a white light moments when the compulsions completely disappeared, and they were different people in the end. And I really wanted that to happen to me. He started by attending church every morning, as he had in his youth. Then one day he chanced upon a book written by the pioneering depth psychologist C.G. Jung. It was titled Synchronicity, and it contained the story of a troubled patient who dreamt of a golden scarab which didn't exist in that locality. Suddenly, that very flying insect tapped gently on the windowpane, then landed on Jung's palm. Where he presented it to the woman. The chances of that happening were one in a trillion, Bobby realized. Jung thought such things were interventions by God in our lives. They defied the laws of nature and of mathematics. He was a scientist and tried to reproduce these instances in a clinical setting. Excuse me. Ooh. But was very honest about the fact that he couldn't prove the existence of God using empirical and scientific skills. But Jung described having seen thousands of patients coming through his hospital, including a high percentage of alcoholics, who he could show based upon anecdotal evidence that if they believed in God, their recovery was more durable than those who did not. At that point, God had gotten a great distance from me. My dilemma was a very common one. How do you start believing in something that you can't see or smell or taste or hear or acquire with your senses? Jung solves that problem in the book, putting forward the German version of fake it till you make it. You act as if you believe in God. And I started acting as if there were a God watching me all the time. I started I started breaking my day down into about 40 different little choices, and each one took on a spiritual dimension. Simple things. Do I get up in the morning when my alarm goes off? Or do I sleep through or stay in bed with indolent thoughts? Do I hang up the towels, brush my teeth, make my bed as soon as I get up? Do I put water in an ice tray before I put it back in the freezer? When I go into the closet and put on a pair of pants and some of those wire hangers fall to the floor, do I shut the door like I used to and think I'm too busy to pick them up, or that's somebody else's job? Do I put the shopping carts back where they're supposed to go? Bobby would later learn that Jung had had a powerful influence on the recovery movement, becoming a foundation stone upon which Alcoholics Anonymous was built. I was about to leave one day after doing an interview with Bobby, when he suggested we sit outside on his porch. Then he began to talk with the benefit of 38 years of hindsight into what he'd been through and what he'd been able to make of it. "I have an addictive personality, which means that the way I process the world, my mind is like a formulation pharmacy. It can turn anything into a drug. That could be exercise, ice cream, candy, my career, or whatever. He continued, one of the features of all addictions is this illusion that you can fix whatever pain is inside of you and fill whatever empty spaces are in your soul with things that are outside of you. There's been a long time in my life when I reacted to everything that way. In my teenage years, I was essentially just a bundle of appetites that constantly demanded to be fed, and I had no defenses against them and no techniques for figuring out other options. What maturity in the 12-step program brings is a series of techniques that give me a little interstitial space between my impulse and my action that allows me to change my biological destiny in those little instances. By thinking through, by using prayer, the more you exercise those muscles, the stronger they get. The writer Susan Sontag once said that addicts have a unique opportunity for redemption because they've lived in hell. The way you're living is so wrong to yourself, to all of your senses and sensibilities, that you get desperate enough and powerless enough that you can surrender to a higher power. Nobody goes into the 12-step meetings when they are on a winning streak. They do it because what they're doing with their lives isn't working. I had an experience early in my sobriety. At one of the first meetings I ever went to, a guy talking was a big drug smuggler from the 70s. He had an operation bringing pot up from Mexico with a big fleet of trucks and hundreds of people working for him. He was making $1 million a week. Then he got busted and he lost everything. He'd gone into rehab and received treatment, and he was now working in a clinic for minimum wage cleaning lab jars. He said that he came early, tried to clean the jars better than anybody else, and left late, and that he took joy and found peace in doing little things well, the kind of things that in his former career he was too much of a big shot to do. But the humility and the simplicity of doing this was what gave him joy and peace. I got a lot of inspiration from that. And at that time, I was a lawyer, but not practicing law. I'd started working for Riverkeeper, but I had a very humbling job, doing essentially janitorial work, putting together a field station that would be Riverkeeper's headquarters up in the Hudson Valley. I painted that house myself. I swept the floors, all that kind of stuff. And I also took a vow I was going to keep my mouth shut for 5 years and become an expert at what I was doing. When the house was ready, I had to furnish it. I wanted to do a good job of finding cheap but nice furniture and getting it transported. So I borrowed a big pickup truck from one of my friends, and I found a warehouse sale in New Jersey, and I drove down with my list of all the necessary items, desks, lamps, rugs, beds, and so on. I packed them really well into the back of the truck, jam-packed into the flatbed in a way that they wouldn't fall out. But one thing I didn't do was tie them in. I was driving up the Garden State Parkway, and I hit a big pothole. There was a racket from the back, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and the bed of the truck was empty. The gate was open, and there was foam rubber and splinters all over the highway. I got out. I'm not somebody who cries, but I was ready to. I felt as low as I could go. Here, I couldn't even do this very humbling job right. I've packed hundreds of pickup trucks since then. This is funny, cute. Sorry. I've packed hundreds of pickup trucks since then, and I always tie stuff in. The way that we learn is through pain. When I was a teenager and into my 20s, my strategy was to anesthetize it. But when I got sober at 28 years old, I had to learn all those lessons. And what I found was, when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I was like a big truck stuck in a ditch with flame coming out, coming from the headers and the pipes, and sound and fury and roaring, revving engines and smoke pouring out of the tailpipe. Going nowhere, spinning the wheels, all activity and no progress. One of the things I learned after that incident with the truck was just how to be still. There's a line from Isaiah that really helped. Be still and know that I am God. In other words, God is in charge. I don't have to fix what was wrong with something outside of me to expose the wrong inside of me. So I learned to be still and to listen to other people, to the universe, and not react to everything. It says a lot of times in the Bible, it came to pass, which means whatever you're feeling right now is going to pass. And many times it just means sitting on the train patiently and waiting for the scenery to change. Pain is the touchstone to spiritual growth. And if you don't experience the pain, you don't have any spiritual growth. Hopefully, what we get from enduring the pain... Hopefully what we get from enduring that pain is wisdom. The meaning of the word wisdom is a knowledge of God's will. In other words, an intuitive sense of right and wrong in every situation. To understand what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to react intuitively. I did not have that when I was young, and I have that now. Through trying to discipline many of my impulses. He would tell his AA group, "The question is, how do I stay in that posture of surrender, even when everything's going well in my life? That's why I still go to meetings every day. When I first started, I asked someone, 'How long do you have to go to these meetings?' And he said, 'Just keep coming until you like it.' I've been in it for 38 years, and I don't enjoy it or look forward to it. But I don't want to live with the consequences of what my life will look like if I stop. The 12-step brought order out of the chaos of my life and turned all the mayhem of my addiction into capital that I could use to help other alcoholics or addicts." That is the end of chapter 8. Let's see. Shall we do chapter 9? I'll do chapter 9. Becoming a River Keeper. Upon graduating from the University of Virginia Law School, Bobby started full-time employment as an assistant DA in Robert Morgenthau's office after passing the bar exam in February of 1983. There he spent a year prosecuting misdemeanor assaults, cases, assault prostitutes, and fare beaters. But after he entered the rehabilitation center, Bobby understood how much his life needed to change and hopefully take on deeper meaning. In January of 1984, the same month he turned 30, Bobby commenced 2 years of court. Bobby commenced 2 years of court-ordered probation. He had been ordered by Rapid City judge to continue his treatment and go through periodic drug testing while performing 15,000 hours of community service in New York State, where he resided. Bobby was in the process of moving from his apartment into a rented house near the Hudson River in Bedford, 45 minutes outside the city. "I met Bobby when he was really trying to refocus his life," remembers John Adams. Excuse me. Part of a group from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, who had co-founded the nation's first environmental advocacy group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. In 1970, he had determined Sorry, I'm not reading this very well. He had a determination to head in a direction that he cared about, and if possible, it was going to be the environment. I'm going to pause it here for a minute. We made a suggestion that he might want to start by working on Hudson River issues because I was then on the board of the Hudson River Fishermen's Association. Bobby took Adams up on accepting a volunteer internship to fulfill his court-ordered community service. My decision to work on environmental issues was consistent with my other efforts to retrace my steps to that point where I had started off on the wrong path, he would recall. He began commuting to the bucolic hamlet of Garrison, where Adams lived. He asked me to help him with a project to preserve the Osborne estate, Bobby recalled. He wanted to turn the old farmhouse into a research facility for scientists and environmental groups to use to study and protect the Hudson River. He asked me to go up there to prepare the farmhouse for occupation, which I did with the employ of about 20 prisoners from the Beacon Correctional Facility. It was fitting that his assignment revolved around the Hudson River. Bobby would remember President Kennedy telling of the trip that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison made up the Hudson in 1800 on a botanical expedition, ending up at Tammany Hall, in New York City, and forming the Democratic Party. In the winter of 1965, 11-year-old Bobby had accompanied his father to kayak the river's upper reaches in the Adirondack Mountains to paddle the Whitewater Derby. His dad hoped the trip would help bring attention to the Hudson's spectacular headwaters and help to derail a proposed dam on the Hudson River Gorge. Senator Kennedy and his young relatives found the rapids impossible to read, so we kept capsizing and ended up swimming several formidable rapids. While similar trips out west were marked by delicious river water to drink, Bobby was shocked when those outfitters said the Hudson River water was poison. Even at that age, it occurred to me, that's a theft involved here, or there's a theft involved here, and I took it personally. The outrage stayed with me. His father had returned from the Hudson excursion to call the pollution he saw a disgrace to America that had to be cleaned up. The next year, a coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen mobilized. Their leader was a Sports Illustrated writer turned activist named Robert Boyle, who formed a Hudson River Fishermen's Association. He was the first journalist to call attention to PCBs contaminating local fish. The NRDC represented the Fishermen's Association in successful legal challenges, and the old farmhouse that the environmental group asked Bobby to turn into a research facility was designed for Boyle's organization. Bobby had first become familiar with the Hudson Valley while attending Millbrook in his middle school years. Now he devoured Boyle's book, The Hudson River, A Natural and Unnatural History, which advocated in the muck, waders on environmentalism, and in which Boyle foresaw enlisting someone to be, quote, out on the river the length of the year, nailing polluters on the spot, end quote. Boyle's models were the English river keepers who protected private trout streams against poachers. The Hudson hosted commercial fishermen who had been supporting their families off their catch since colonial times. In 1966, as Bobby recounted in the speech announcing his presidential candidacy, a leaky pipe from the Penn Central Railroad sent diesel oil up the river and blackened the beaches, and their fish couldn't be sold. Several hundred men and women came together in an American Legion Hall, only to realize that the agencies supposed to be protecting the river had become the sock puppets for the industry they were supposed to be regulating. Many of them combat veterans. The fishermen were talking about a violent response when Boyle told them about an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers Act that said it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States. The law had never been enforced in 80 years, but it was still on the books, Bobby recalled. Boyle suggested, "We shouldn't be talking about breaking the law. We should be talking about enforcing it." Out of this, Riverkeeper was born. 18 months later, they shut down the pipe and used the money they collected to go after other destructive corporations. I wanted to be in the trenches working with people and engaged in hand-to-hand combat against the big polluters, Bobby said in his announcement, and I wanted to particularly work with people who were most harmed by environmental injury, but also were alienated or marginalized from the mainstream environmental community. Fortuitously for Bobby, in 1983, Boyle had hired John Cronin to launch a 25-foot patrol boat as the first full-time Hudson River keeper. Cronin was a city kid from Yonkers, 6 years older than Bobby, who'd started out as a draft counselor for the Quakers and anti-war organizer during the Vietnam War era of the 1960s. He'd moved on to Sleuth for Pete Seeger's Clearwater organization, collecting evidence that resulted in conviction of a Hudson River polluter for violating the 1972 Clean Water Act. Cronin had also worked as a legislative aide in the New York State Assembly Committee on Environmental Conservation. Tiring of office routine, he became a commercial fisherman, learning to read tides and handle nets in all kinds of weather. The river went from being something I acknowledged to something I understood, Cronin said. Bobby met Cronin in mid-February 1984 and says he liked him instantly. Bobby described him as eloquent, thoughtful, and utterly committed, with a talent for tactics and strategy. In the book he eventually co-authored with Cronin, Bobby described going on many outings with Bob Boyle in that first spring, fly fishing and beach sinning and scuba diving from canoes, all along with their hiking together in the woods. It was a way of getting my bearings, of adapting to a new home by systematically developing the same sort of familiarity with my surroundings and its indigenous plants and animals as I'd had with the Virginia and Cape Cod homes of my youth. I learned to think of the Hudson Valley as my home, my place. And although he and Boyle would never develop the intimacy of his relationship with Lem Billings, Bobby clearly enjoyed having a new older mentor. Boyle understood Bobby's struggles and inspired him to move forward. "You can seek a new life through the river and through ecology," Boyle once told Bobby. Fittingly, like a master musician passing along his instrument, Boyle gave Bobby his time-honored fishing net. While continuing to work under the auspices of the NRDC, before long, Bobby would be partnering with those two Irishmen, Boyle and Cronin, first as an investigator. Boyle would later remember Bobby saying to him, "Riverkeeper has saved my life. It's given me something to live for." Boyle concurred, "I think what gave meaning to his life was his growing realization that there was a lot to do for his Hudson River and the world. I saw almost an awakening. Look what I can do." That was my sense of what it could do for him. It turned him around. Bobby remembers his first project came about like this. Joe Augustin, a pawn shop operator with a giant afro and energy as abundant as his notable girth, showed up at the office one day and with horror stories about political corruption, environmental catastrophe in his community. He lived in the small town of Newburgh, 60 miles north of New York City. It was poor, with predominantly black and Hispanic population. And Bobby would soon realize a town that regularly leads the nation in virtually every criterion used to measure urban decay and is famed for producing local politicians with elastic ethics and a knack for plundering the public trust. Bobby and Cronin were initially worried about Newburgh's plan to sell its boat ramp, the only public access to the riverfront, to a developer who planned to build a floating restaurant there. When they went to the developer asking if he'd still permit the public to use the ramp, the man's partner is said to have responded, "We are not going to have spades drinking and screwing and swimming around our new boat ramp, if that's what you mean by the public." Bobby later wrote, "At that moment, I knew I wanted to be an environmental lawyer. An ambivalence I'd felt about having abandoned the battle for social justice when I took up arms for a clean environment was gone." Like his father before him, Bobby knew it was really all one thing, the pollution and the racism, and it infuriated him. Joe Augustin also told Cronin about industrial sewage discharges at the foot of a minor stream that meandered along Newburgh's southern border known as Quiasic Creek. "Our investigation," Bobby and Cronin wrote later in the Riverkeepers, "took us into pipes and culverts and underneath ancient factories. We mounted 24-hour surveillance of intermittent pipes. We sat for days on lawn chairs to sample factory and sewer plant outfalls, and set traps to catch liquids being dumped at odd hours. We scuba dived in the Hudson to collect evidence of illegal dumping and donned wetsuits to swim across a pond on a cold winter night to collect samples from an unpermitted pipe. We carried backpacks filled with sampling vials, flashlights, maps, notepads, a camera, and occasionally fishing rods to avoid suspicion. It was as if the conquering of those Latin American rivers had morphed into an even deeper dive into primordial matter, one with representative consequences, even in the smallest of tributaries." A profile of Bobby in the Outside magazine continued, "Donning waders, Kennedy walked every foot of the Quiasic's Dantean 7-mile length. He seined for fish among brown trout and river pickles, human fecal matter, until the cuts in his hands began to fester. Seeking the source of the raw sewage, he discovered another pipe belching volatile chemicals, and Cronin lowered him into the culvert. Had Culvert lowered him into the culvert, sampled the dregs, and discovered quantities of naphthalene, a toxic solvent known to cause mutations and blood disorders in animals. After tracing the effluent to a textile company that had illegally connected its discharge pipe into a city sewer line, he and Cronin scaled the company's roof to check its emissions sources and found 24 illegal pipes and stacks discharging liquid and chemical fumes. Eventually, Kennedy and his co-workers identified 24 separate polluters on the Quiasic. My eyeballs. Sorry, guys. Okay, I'm trying. All right. They brought 16 lawsuits, all settled before trial, yielding pledges from each defendant to stop polluting and clean up the creek, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in penalties and fines. Literally deep in the shit, in a microcosmic forerunner of what lay ahead, Bobby quickly made enemies. Newburgh's town supervisor eventually told New York Magazine Here was this Kennedy kid running all over town, sloshing around in the creek, talking to the press, using his fancy name. He was saying that the town had a sewer problem. Well, I knew that. I don't think there is anyone more concerned about the environment than me. Then he sued us without even coming in and talking first to the board. Took the town to court over the sewage problem. Kennedy isn't from around here, and neither were the people working with him. To have to bargain with people of that type makes me sick. The supervisor claimed that Bobby and Boyle's Fishermen's Association were committing legalized extortion, alleging that the activists used lawsuits and threats to shake the town down for money. This was after Bobby presented 20 strong cases to the United States Attorney's Office, which decided to prosecute 4 of them. Bobby's response? He really hates my guts, as Cronin later summarized. They were saying everything he did was politically motivated and that he planned to run for office. They painted him out to be a carpetbagger, but he never took the bait. Indeed, Bobby stayed away from the press conference announcing the outcomes of the Battle of Quassaic Creek. This remained his policy during his first 5 years with Riverkeeper because he was afraid press interest in my involvement might distract from the central issue. Cronin told Outside writer Barry Wirth another reason for Bobby's avoidance of taking public credit. Bobby didn't want to appear as if he was using this issue as an instant rehabilitation. Asked what effect that first venture into tracking down polluters had on him, Bobby replied, I saw the connection between poverty and pollution in addition to the connection between erosion of democracy and the erosion of our environment and natural treasures. It was a motif his father had introduced, and one that would dominate the rest of his life. Cronin recalled in 2022 that Bobby became very interested in the law, the Clean Water Act specifically, and its rules and permit system. He started finding things. One of the first was, wait a second, the company, have to do monthly reports. Let's look at them. So he started pulling some, and he said, they're just reporting their violations every month and not doing anything about it. That set out an agenda for us for virtually the next 10 years, going after polluters who through subterfuge or lying or hidden activities were violating the Clean Water Act. We were each equally comfortable with investigative paperwork or pulling on a pair of hip boots and getting out in the water and the mud. So we formed an unexpected but natural partnership over the next year, and his original community service evolved into becoming our chief attorney. In 1985, Hudson Riverkeeper promoted Bobby to senior attorney, the same year that Exxon agreed to cease its tanker traffic on the Hudson. This harkened back to the Riverkeeper beginnings in mid-1983, before Bobby came on board. An NBC News crew had agreed to follow Cronin out to look for oil tankers, said to be siphoning fresh water 90 miles upriver from their entry into the New York Harbor. Over a 3-year period, Cronin estimated Exxon had stolen 700 million gallons of water. The story ended by making news around the world. In 1986, Exxon paid $1.5 million to the state and $500,000 to the fishermen, with half that money going to fund Riverkeeper. The Croton River feeds into the Hudson, not far from where Cronin grew up, and now a favorite fishing spot for Bobby. On Christmas Eve, 1985, a local fisherman alerted Cronin that workers planned to pump toxic liquid from Westchester County's Croton Point landfill into the Hudson. They chose Christmas, the whistleblower told Cronin, because they figure you guys won't be around. So Cronin and Bobby spent Christmas Day at a garbage dump with a bone-chilling wind blowing across the river. Croton landfill turned out to be an environmental nightmare. Hundreds of thousands of tons of domestic garbage and 1 billion pounds of industrial wastes, including a radioactive building buried in 200 acres of Hudson River tidal marsh. By the next spring, Riverkeeper had collected enough evidence of unpermitted discharges from the storm sewer into the river to start our own citizen suit. Interest in Riverkeeper mushroomed. We needed nothing less than a team of prosecutors to meet the public demand for our work, according to Bobby. Soon he would get just that. Bobby hadn't taken a single course in environmental law in law school, because there really wasn't a discipline called environmental law at the time. With a growing sense of purpose, Bobby attended Pace Law School and got an advanced degree known as a Master of Laws, or LLM, in environmental law. He did so well there that the Pace faculty asked Bobby to create an environmental litigation clinic where second and third year law students would work on cases under his supervision. He said he'd do it on one condition, that this could happen in conjunction with Hudson Riverkeeper and a nation Long Island Soundkeeper as the clients. Kennedy went to the New York State Court of Appeals to obtain a special order allowing his 10 clinic students to actually try cases in state and federal courtrooms. In a small building whose entryway held an aquarium full of Hudson River fish, the clinic was soon suing dozens of municipal wastewater treatment plants to force them to comply with the Clean Water Act and taking on huge polluting corporations like General Electric. When the clinic opened in September of 1987, the first case revolved around the Croton landfill. Bobby and his students filed a Clean Water Act citizen suit against the county. A judge called the landfill a time bomb. The county attorney stunned everyone by asking for a settlement. The discharges were halted. Tank trucks began to regularly pick up the leachate for disposal at a treatment facility. The landfill was shut down and a plan for its remediation agreed upon, and a program for the restoration of the remains of the Croton Marsh were established. Bobby and Cronin wrote in the Riverkeepers, "It was a massive victory." As River's reputation spread, Pace Clinic quickly evolved into a legal aid agency for many small community environmental organizations. Bobby became a board member of the Long Island Soundkeeper, bringing numerous lawsuits against cities and industries along the coastlines of Connecticut and New York. In 1986, he won a landmark case stopping the practice of lead shot being fired into the sound. And Pace students, his federal lawsuits forced the shutdown of the Pelham Bay landfill and New York athletic clubs for interfering with the public's ability to use the sound. And Pace students uncovered more than 3,000 violations of the Clean Water Act by the cities of Norfolk, Bridgeport, and Milford, with indications of similar situations in a half dozen other cities. While Bobby covered the legal waterfront, his riverkeeper partner, John Cronin, did a lot of the on-site research, including sometimes anchoring and crawling through huge pipes seeking evidence of midnight dumping. A 1990 profile of Cronin in People magazine described how, in its first 7 years, Riverkeeper had successfully brought 40 enforcement cases and lawsuits against polluters. The reason we had been able to save the river is that we'd used public relations, politics, and the courts, Bobby told the magazine. John knows how to work them all. Looking back, Cronin sees a misconception concerning Bobby's Riverkeeper efforts. It's been told in such broad strokes that it does him a disservice, Cronin says. The portrait that's often been painted is the courtroom attorney who saved the Hudson. No slam against litigators, but the work he did required so much more skill and determination than that. Litigation is a war of nerves. Who's going to give in first? Who's going to challenge who? Who has the best information? I could recite to you a dozen times when that's exactly where he and I were with opposing forces. Cronin remembers a specific instance with Mobil Oil's chief counsel. They were negotiating on a conference call when the lawyer informed them, "I'm about to get on a plane to Russia, and if I do, I'll see you in court. There's going to be no settlement here, and you're going to lose. You've got until tomorrow." When the call ended in a stalemate, Cronin recollects, "Bobby and I went over all our facts, and then he said to me, 'What do you think? We're not going to give in, right?' I said, 'No, we're not.' And the Mobil attorney called us from the airport an hour before his flight took off and said, okay, he'd schedule settlement negotiations for when he comes back. It never went to court." Cronin further explained the complexity of the suits and the settlements. You had to be able to muster the information to win against a seasoned corporate attorney. It's rarely some Clarence Darrow closing argument in an open courtroom. Bobby needed a whole host of skills, and he developed them. Those stereotypical portraits of Bobby don't really recognize what goes into sometimes very complex cases that It's rarely some Clarence Darrow closing argument in an open courtroom. Bobby needed a whole host of skills, and he developed them. These stereotypical portraits of Bobby don't really recognize what goes into sometimes very complex cases that don't just involve the Clean Water Act, but property law, contracts, and corporate history. Following the publication of Bobby and Cronin's book in 1997, the Riverkeeper movement spread west, seeing the launch of Baykeepers in San Francisco, Santa Monica, and Seattle. By then, sturgeon had returned to the Hudson, along with shad, herring, eel, and blue crabs. So had the Atlantic striped bass, the vaunted migratory species that had enabled the pilgrims to survive their first winters along Cape Cod, and that only a decade earlier had seemed on the verge of collapse. And that is chapter 8 and 9. I'm ending it there. Chapter 10 will be on the next episode. It's called A Fish Story. And we'll see you back another time. I hope you're enjoying the story. I sure am.